A class by His Holiness Devamrita Swami on Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th canto, 8th chapter, text number 54, given on the 17th of October 2015 in Maharashtra, India.
Mantrinanena Devasya Kurya Dravya Maim Buddha Paryam Vividaya Dravya Deshakala Vibhagavit. Translation. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. This is the 12-syllable mantra for worshipping Lord Krishna. One should install the physical form of the Lord, and with the chanting of the mantra, one should offer flowers and fruits and other varieties of foodstuffs exactly according to the rules and regulations prescribed by authorities. But this should be done in consideration of place, time, and attendant conveniences and inconveniences. Purport. Srila Prabhupada chooses to give a medium to long purport. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya is known as the Dvadashakshara Mantra. This mantra is chanted by Vaishnava devotees and begins with pranava or omkara. There is an injunction that those who are not brahmanas cannot pronounce the pranava mantra. But Dhruva Maharaj was born a kshatriya. He had once admitted before Narada Muni that as a kshatriya he was unable to accept Narada's instruction of renunciation and mental equilibrium, which are the concern of a brahmana. Still, although not a brahmana but a kshatriya, Dhruva was allowed, on the authority of Narada, to pronounce the pranava omkara. This is very significant. Especially in India, the caste brahmanas object greatly when persons from other castes who are not born in brahmana families recite this pranava mantra. But here is tacit proof that if a person accepts the Vaishnav mantra or Vaishnav way of worshipping the deity, he is allowed to chant the pranava mantra. In Bhagavad Gita, the Lord personally accepts that anyone, even one of low species, can be elevated to the highest position and go back home, back to Godhead, simply if he worships properly. The prescribed rules, as stated here by Narada Muni, are that one should accept the mantra through a bona fide spiritual master and hear the mantra in the right ear. Not only should one chant or murmur the mantra, but in front of him he must have the deity or physical form of the Lord. Of course, when the Lord appears, it is no longer a physical form. For example, when an iron rod is made red hot in a fire, it is no longer iron, it is fire. Similarly, when we make a form of the Lord, whether of wood or stone or metal or jewels or paint, or even a form within the mind, it is bona fide. It is a bona fide spiritual transcendental form of the Lord. Not only must one receive the mantra from the bona fide spiritual master like Narada Muni or his representative in the succession, but one must chant the mantra. And not only must one chant, but he should also offer foodstuff, whatever foodstuff is available in his part of the world, according to time and convenience. The method of worship, chanting the mantra and preparing the forms of the Lord, is not stereotyped, nor is it exactly the same everywhere. It is specifically mentioned in this verse that one should take consideration of the time, place, and available conveniences. Our Krishna consciousness movement is going on throughout the entire world, and we also install deities in different centers. Sometimes our Indian friends, puffed up with concocted notions, criticize. This has not been done. That has not been done. But they forget this instruction of Narada Muni to one of the greatest Vaishnavas, Dhruva Maharaj. One has to consider the particular time, country, and conveniences. What is convenient in India may not be convenient in the Western countries, those who are not actually in the line of acharyas, or who personally have no knowledge of how to act in the role of acharya, unnecessarily criticize the activities of the ISKCON movement in countries outside of India. The fact is that such critics cannot do anything personally to spread Krishna consciousness. If someone does go and preach, taking all risks and allowing all considerations for time and place, it might be that there are changes in the manner of worship, but that is not at all faulty according to Shastra. Srimad Viraraghava Acharya in the disciplic succession of the Ramanuja Sampradaya, has remarked in his commentary that chandalas, or conditioned souls, who are born in lower than Shudra families, can also be initiated according to circumstances. The formalities may be slightly changed here and there to make them Vaishnavas. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu recommends that his name should be heard in every nook and corner of the world. How is this possible unless one preaches everywhere? The cult of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Bhagavad Dharma, and he especially recommends Krishna Katha, or the cult of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. He recommends that every Indian, considering this task to be Pada Upakar, or welfare activity, takes the Lord's message to other residents of the world. Other residents of the world does not refer only to those who are exactly like the Indian Brahmanas and Kshatriyas, or like the caste Brahmanas, who claim to be Brahmanas because they were born in the families of Brahmanas. The principle that only Indians and Hindus should be brought into the Vaishnava cult is a mistaken idea. There should be propaganda to bring everyone to the Vaishnava cult. The Krishna consciousness movement is meant for this purpose. There's no bar to propagating the Krishna consciousness movement, even among people who are born in Chandala, Malecha, or Yavana families. Even in India, this point has been enunciated by Srila Sanatana Goswami in his book, Hari Bhakti Vilas, which is Smriti and is the authorized Vedic guide for Vaishnavas in their daily behavior. Sanatana Goswami says that as bell metal can turn to gold when mixed with mercury in a chemical process, so by the bona fide diksha, or initiation method, anyone can become a Vaishnava. One should take initiation from a bona fide spiritual master coming in the disciplic succession, who is authorized by his predecessor spiritual master. This is called Diksha Vidhana. Lord Krishna states in Bhagavad Gita, Vyapasritya, one should accept a spiritual master. By this process, the entire world can be converted to Krishna consciousness. Om Ganatimadandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militangena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shivasadi Gaur Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada and the previous acharyas who have chosen to comment on this verse all point out that the consideration of desha kala, place, time, with its intended conveniences and inconveniences, first of all, refers to the fact that ordinarily, from a common understanding, not a correct understanding, but according to a common understanding of Shastra, Dhruva Maharaj shouldn't have gotten the mantra. So based on that point, Srila Prabhupada then expands in his purport about those born outside of India, or those born in not caste Brahmana families, how they have a right to receive the mantra in parampara. So let's look at, first of all, let's look at Dhruva Maharaj's situation. He was not born in a Brahmana family. And frankly, he admitted to Narada Muni, I can't accept your advice. It's correct. He never doubted Narada Muni's advice. But I can't accept it because I'm too much of a Kshatriya, I'm too passionate, I'm too attached to my material desires. Narada Muni, as you recall, knew about Dhruva's determination. Such a young boy leaving home, as soon as he heard from his mother that he could find Vishnu in the forest, and there he would have all his desires fulfilled. Noting that determination, Narada Muni arrived on the scene as part of the transcendental system. That system involves the Lord in the heart as a supersoul, and it also involves Narada Muni's prowess being beyond time and space considerations. His knowledge is not limited by physical factors of the universe. By the teamwork of Narada Muni and the Chaitya Guru, Dhruva is in the rarest situation. He is face to face with Narada Muni, and he's receiving transcendental knowledge. Narada Muni pointed out to him these insults, these honors of the world. They come and go. One should not be disturbed by them. One should accept everything in the process given by the Supreme Personality of Godhead as auspicious and utilize everything for increasing one's dependency on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Understand that your happiness and distress comes to you by your karma, and go to another level. In other words, don't try to solve this problem on the same level that it originated. Supposedly, Albert Einstein is quoted for that principle. A problem is never truly solved on the same level that it originated. So whenever I quote that, of course, I widen the context. Here you see Narada Muni saying, what are you doing being locked up on this platform of karmic happiness and distress? Rise above it. See your life as part of the wonderful process of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And be grateful for whatever comes your way, utilizing whatever comes your way as impetus to please Krishna more. After giving such wonderful advice to Dhruva, and then testing Dhruva, how determined are you anyway? You're so young. Don't you know practically no one ever achieves the supreme goal? Don't you understand? The greatest saints, the greatest yogis endeavor for the ultimate realization. They practically never get it. And here you are, a little boy. Let's get real. Think about the real world, Dhruva. But Dhruva was so determined. And he told Narada Muni that your advice is correct. This is very important. He didn't, in his mind or with his words, reject the advice of Narada Muni. Yes, but actually, you don't really understand. You don't understand the circumstances. My situation is unique. Dhruva totally accepted the perfect advice given by Narada Muni in that he said, yes, you're right, but I can't swallow the pill. I've got too much Kshatriya ambition, too much Ishwar Bhava. I've got too much pride. Please, although I'm full of material desires, don't reject me. So you see, first, Narada Muni gave Dhruva advice that voided all material desires. But Dhruva couldn't swallow it, although he knew it was right. Therefore, Narada Muni did not reject Dhruva, even though Dhruva was loaded with material desires, such intense ambition. He wanted a kingdom greater than his father, Maharaj Uttanabad, who ruled the whole world. He wanted a kingdom greater than Manu, Uttanapad's father. And he wanted a greater kingdom than Brahma himself. He wanted something impossible. Yet Narada Muni knew that by worshiping the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the impossible can happen. And Narada Muni was impressed by Dhruva's sincere determination, in spite of all the material motivations. Actually, Bhagavatam explains that Narada Muni considered Dhruva's extraordinary material ambitions to be childish. So here you see the time, place, and circumstances. Ordinarily, Dhruva should not have gotten the mantra. He's not a brahmana by birth, and he's not a brahmana by quality. He himself admits that. But he's in touch with the right person. And he's submissively listening to the right person. Even though he can't accept the prescription, he says, "You're right, but I can't follow it because of my problems, my inherent problems. But please," in other words, he's saying, "Please don't reject me. Please help me." So Narada Muni gives a program by which Dhruva will become perfect in self-realization. He teaches Dhruva the Ashtanga Yoga system of meditating on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, while at the same time chanting this Dvadashakshara mantra, the 12-syllable mantra, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. And Narada Muni describes that this is a confidential mantra. So then the point can be raised, doesn't confidential mean that you don't speak it, you don't tell anyone? But no, the Shastra has a different meaning of confidential. Throughout Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, "Arjuna, I'm going to tell you confidential knowledge. Arjuna, I'm going to tell you knowledge more confidential than what I told you before. Arjuna, I'm going to tell you the most confidential knowledge." That's chapter 18. Okay, but it's all there in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says it's confidential, more confidential, most confidential, but he's speaking it. Anyone can read it. So what's going on? We see the confidential mantra, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So how is it that this is a secret? So in this way, we have to understand Vaishnava epistemology, science of knowing. There are two things involved. First one I often speak about, how understanding knowledge, bhakti knowledge, is state-specific. According to the state of your consciousness, that determines what you can understand. This principle is totally against the Western notion that your behavior has nothing to do with what your intellect can grasp. You can behave whatever way you like. You can trash out your consciousness in whatever way you like. But your intelligence will not be affected. In fact, your intelligence, your ability to understand, is independent of your consciousness and your behavior in terms of the quality. But the Vedic method is completely different. That according to your lifestyle, which will of course affect your consciousness, that determines what you can understand. So therefore, in the Vaishnav line, achar is so much stressed. Your behavior. Your behavior influences your consciousness. Your consciousness influences your behavior. And certain state of consciousness will prevent you from understanding, and a certain state of consciousness will allow you to understand the bhakti knowledge. Sometimes even our own devotees have difficulty understanding this point, because it seems that, especially in the West, not so much maybe in India, but in the West, all right, I'm not following the rules or I'm not chanting my rounds, but my intelligence is still functioning perfectly. No lightning bolt has hit me. I'm just as good as the other Prabhus. Probably better because I'm less fanatical. So what's this point about that my, because I'm not strictly following, that therefore I cannot understand? Come on, I've read Bhagavad Gita, you've read Bhagavad Gita, what's the difficulty? Srila Prabhupada once very charitably said, that the only difference between his disciples and him was that his disciples had no fear of Maya. And he was always praying to Krishna, please don't let me fall down. In other words, by saying that, he was trying to impart to us a very healthy fear of the illusory energy and what it can do in terms of covering your consciousness. But the Western world is very famous for its cavalier attitude, a very carefree attitude that I can act in this way and that, but my intelligence, my cognitive powers are still sharp. The second principle that is so prominent in Vaishnava understanding and not there in Western understanding is that your knowledge depends on another person. First of all, knowledge is state specific. And then secondly, knowledge depends on who you're in contact with. In other words, who have you got blessings from? We look, for example, in Chaitanya Lila. Lord Chaitanya was reciting a verse that was very confidential. Whenever he would see Lord Jagannath in the temple, whenever Lord Jagannath would be on the cart, Lord Chaitanya would recite, Yakumara Hara, now I've met the thief who stole my heart in youth. He's once again my master. Rupa Goswami heard this recitation and composed a verse explaining it more, expanding the meaning of the verse. Piyatsoyam Krishna. He wrote it on a palm leaf, as you know, and put it in the roof of his hut and went out. And then Mahaprabhu happened to come and saw the verse. So what was Mahaprabhu's first question to Rupa Goswami? After coming out of his ecstasy, Mahaprabhu said, how did you know my intentions? How did you understand this? He lovingly even slapped Rupa Goswami. How did you know? In other words, how is it that you've cognited this? How is it that you figured all this out? And then Mahaprabhu showed the verse to Srup Damodar and asked the same question. How does he know my intentions? How does he understand all this? In other words, this is so confidential. But in his verse, he's encapsulated my inner meaning perfectly. And what was Srup Damodar's response? This can only happen because he has your mercy. Because he has contacted your mercy, therefore he can see and understand. Mahaprabhu acknowledged that, and then went on further to say, now I will empower him with all the necessary vision and potency to spread bhakti. And he said to Srup Damodar, he, Rupa Goswami, is fit to understand the confidential rasa tattva. You instruct him further. Sometimes in Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is stated that no one can understand the confidential truths about Lord Chaitanya's feelings of separation. If anyone does, they must have got it from Srup Damodar. In other words, who's the person? This is the way a Vaishnava thinks. Whenever a Vaishnava sees an extraordinary display of bhakti shakti, first the Vaishnava thinks, what level of bhakti consciousness is responsible for all this? And then the second thing the Vaishnava thinks is, who's the person responsible? In other words, who is that person that this devotee is in contact with? That therefore there is such a display. This is a different way from the mundane way. And sometimes we may even forget that. We may think that we may become very impressed with our own intelligence as if it exists, as if our ability to understand bhakti exists independently of our behavior, independently of our purity of consciousness, and independently of another person. This is so difficult to understand from the mundane point of view. How is it that my understanding depends on the blessings of someone else? They don't teach you that at university. It's all up to you. How are you going to compete in the exams? Have you got the right coaching and you memorize the right things for the exams? But in bhakti, we see that without the blessings of another person, what can you understand? Narottam Das Thakur asks the question, Chadiya Vaishnava Seva Nishtha Paichikeva. Who do you know who knows anything factual beyond the material energy who hasn't got the blessings of a Vaishnava? Show me that person. You won't find it. Even Mayavadis acknowledge that one needs a guru at least temporarily. But it's this Western thing that it's all up to me. My powers. But why do I need the blessings of another person to understand? It seems like some kind of Hindu folklore. Some kind of Hindu village taboos. You've got to know the right person if your intelligence is going to function properly. It really sounds quaint, doesn't it? But actually, it is most scientific. Dhruva Maharaj is indeed receiving a confidential mantra because it's coming through parampara. Anyone can read the Sanskrit, but you won't get the realization. You won't get the transcendental experience that the mantra triggers unless the mantra comes through parampara. This is what Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita. Evam parampara praptam, imam rajasyo vidhu. This parampara system is the way the greatest kings understood things in the past. The Rajarshis, the saintly kings, they cognated, they comprehended through parampara. So Krishna tells Arjuna, as you all know very well, I'm going to speak this again to you, the same knowledge, because you have the right state of consciousness and you happen to be in touch with the right person. Therefore, I'm going to repeat the same thing to you, the same thing that appears to have been lost. Sakalenaha mahata yoga nashta parantapa. Lost? Does that mean the shlokas of Bhagavad Gita have become lost? No. The precise meaning has become obscured. in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna doesn't cover up. He lets you know the time factor is so deadly in this world that even knowledge personally spoken by Krishna can appear to become lost. That's how deadly the time factor is. Material existence means forgetfulness. It is not the job of the illusory energy to enlighten us. People sometimes think, you know, experience will teach you. Just accumulate enough life experience and you'll be on top of things. But experience with the illusory energy does not lead to enlightenment. It does not lead to higher awareness. It means you're becoming more and more covered over, all while thinking that you're making advancement. This is the situation we have in the world today, that human beings, in the name of advancement, are destroying their own habitat. Yesterday, we heard about how there are so many barriers for human beings to try to live in a more sustainable way. It's so against their programming. Even our own devotees, we're struggling with this. Of course, in this beautiful place here, you naturally begin to think about these things. And it is true that cutting-edge thinkers are starting to come to the conclusion that it's not simply that human beings have economic problems, political problems, or environmental problems. First of all, they have institutional problems. Their institutions are incapable of solving the interlinked problems of today. But, and it took some decades to move further, actually, institutional problems, that means we must have a human problem because human beings have made the institutions. Okay, another 20 years goes by. Meanwhile, the economic instability, the political uncertainty, the environmental degradation continues. And so now the cutting edge is thinking, okay, first we thought institutional problems, then we realized human problems. Now we're starting to understand that we have to deal with the false Western notion of progress. That's what's underneath the whole mess, that we actually have a false concept of what is the advancement of civilization and what is real progress. Of course, if you listened to Srila Prabhupada, you would have heard that all along. Very bluntly, the dog races on four legs, you race on four wheels, what is the difference? At first, we were enchanted by such statements. Then as we became older, we thought, oh, yeah. Jai Prabhupada. But now as we become even older, we begin to realize that Prabhupada in his unique way was getting underneath the whole mess and pointing out to us that we don't really know what progress is. For example, and yes, being in such a beautiful place inspires us to think in this way. The human way of thinking, and in fact, the way that the whole political economy is arranged, both are based on models of a world that doesn't exist anymore. They're based on models of a world that was full of natural resources and empty of people and manufactured goods. The way of thinking and the systems of economics are all based on a world that is not overloaded with human beings and manufactured goods. So, in other words, everyone's got the lust of the same lust as if they're living in a world that's empty of other people, that's full of natural resources. How to make the lust correspond to the actual circumstances, that is called sustainability. We don't accept that. How to adjust the lust. How to make it so that instead of bucks, there are green bucks. Instead of fossil fuel energy, there's green energy. In other words, all that tinkering has some value, but it's so superficial, so peripheral. What is the real problem? The real problem is the lust. Srila Prabhupada once commented that economic development means lust on an organized scale. Take some thought. He says things in a very simple way, but he's actually getting underneath the whole mess and just lifting it out into the light for everyone to see. So everyone knows what individual lust is, unfortunately. And then, lust on an organized scale? Yes, that is economic development. Even the secular thinkings are starting to understand now that sustainability is not enough. Tinkering with the externals is not enough. We have a human problem, and a human problem means that we have a false concept of progress. Unless you deal with that misunderstanding of progress, you're not going to be able to solve the situation. The climate destabilization has progressed too far. So then there's a debate. Just like sometimes devotees in our outreach, we debate with ourselves, with others, how much doomsday should we be? Should we just say, you've got four big problems: birth, death, disease, and old age? Or should we say that however you are living now, that's nice, just add Krishna and everything will be all right? Or should we do both? These are legitimate debates that devotees have with themselves and with others. But it's amazing, the same debates go on in another way in amidst secular thinkers. How do we reach the people? The fact is, and we all know it, the scientists all know, that simply slowing down the present way of life will not save the day. Things are too far gone. But should we say that? If we say that, we'll freak the people out, or else they'll just dismiss us as doomsday talkers. It's like, just like if we just come up to someone and say, got four problems: birth, death, disease, and old age. People may just look at you a little strange. It's true, but they may just not take you seriously. It's just doomsday talk. The end is coming. We've heard it all the time. So what to do? So these secular thinkers, they know. Actually, the game is over. But if we tell people that, they'll be completely hopeless. There is some window of opportunity to make the catastrophe less. So if we discourage them by telling them the truth, we might be doing a disservice. But if we don't tell the truth, also, we're doing a disservice. What to do? What to do? So it's amazing how the same dilemmas we face in our outreach, secular thinkers, and they're trying to help the world, they're also battling with this. And they've realized that their greatest mistake was to make environmental issues just that, environmental issues, when actually the issue should be framed as human issues. Human beings with a mistaken conception of how to live and what is progress. How are you going to give human civilization another version of progress? One prominent historian of progress, Yeah, academics always have to have a niche. So, one master in the niche of the history of progress said a famous mantra: human beings have advanced in the past, human beings are advancing in the present, and they'll always advance in the future. This is the Dwadasa Sakshara mantra, always quoted. But we laugh, yes, but this is it's amazing how intrinsic this notion is to our worldview and self-view. Things have gotten better, and things will continue to get better. Meanwhile, what is Shukadeva Goswami say in the 12th canto? Tatascha anudinam dharmyam satyam shocham shamadaya. With each passing day, kalena balina rajan, by the force of time, things are deteriorating. We recite the verses, you know. But really, in terms of the practical way that we live in the real world, do we really think that things are getting worse and worse with each passing day by the force of time? Even though the Shastra tells us that this present age is the most degraded time. So we have to think how we've been conditioned. Even our own devotees have a false conception of progress. And that's why Prabhupada said the things he said the way he said them. To wake us up. Whether this way or that way, how are we going to change our notions of progress and point out to the world that they have a wrong notion of progress? It's becoming easier and easier because even the cutting-edge secular thinkers are now coming to this point that they have missed the point. They're not dealing with the disease, they're dealing with the symptoms of the disease. Sustainability was hailed as the great savior, but now it's turned out to be a false god. Because the way devotees think of sustainability generally and the way everyone else thinks, it can be different. Sustainability means sustainable Maya. Be lusty, be greedy in a sustainable way. Claim everything as your own. Identify the body and mind as a self, but in a sustainable, green way. The realization has come to some secular thinkers, the cutting-edge ones, that the sustainability mirage is just that, a mirage. It's blinded us to making the necessary deep fundamental changes. And at the fundamental level is the problem with what is progress. Everyone wants to feel like their life is moving ahead. Everyone wants to feel like their society that they belong to is moving ahead. Do we have the intelligence and courage to reappraise all that, to dissect all that, and hold it up to the light and see that it's a big mistake? So these are some of the challenges that are facing human civilization now. Narada Muni dealt with Dhruva's challenges in such a way that Dhruva so diligently followed his instructions. Narada Muni considered Dhruva's material ambitions to be childish. But Narada was so impressed by Dhruva's determination, he enlisted that determination in such a way that Dhruva would become self-realized. And then, of course, when Dhruva does see the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he actually gets all those benedictions, he laments in such a heart-grabbing way. Now, we may say, well, it's not important that he lamented. You know, I mean, look, he got what he wanted. He did get a kingdom greater than than Brahma. Wow. He scored. He saw the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he got all his material ambitions fulfilled. That's the main thing, you know. But As we become more purified, we take the lamentation of Dhruva Maharaj more seriously, and we take it as the prominent aspect of his encounter with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. What a fool I was. He's not just saying that. He's feeling so despicable. How could I have been so mad? So Srila Prabhupada points out in one of the purports, take this as a lesson. Don't approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead with such material ambitions, or you may have to lament like Dhruva Maharaj. So what do we think? Yeah, well, I don't mind lamenting like him. I mean, look what he got, you know. That shows the difference between our consciousness and what is proper consciousness. Dhruva's lamentation was for real. It was the essence. It was intrinsic. Everything else was superfluous. That's why he asked simply for the benediction, that he can always be in the association of advanced devotees. That is real progress.